Chapter 27 Fire Swamp. We boarded the metro and rode all the way to El Cajon, which was the last stop on the line. Watching the people, I realized I could expect the same kind of treatment in California as I'd experienced in Salt Lake. The people stared at us, giving us plenty of space, pulling their children away. To them, I was just another stranger on the metro. Yes, I might have been a whole lot stranger than some of the others, but I was nothing they would remember. At the end of the day, they'd go home. They'd go on with their lives, but not me. I was trapped. I was never going home. It took about 2 hours to get to the end of the line. It seemed like it took all day. After the all-night bus trip from Salt Lake City, we were all exhausted and mostly rode in silence. But it was obvious that Mitchell was in a good mood. The burden of the prophet was much lighter now that he had put some distance between himself and the law. I couldn't help but see the symbolism in riding to the end of the metro line. That's exactly how I felt. I was at the end of the line. So far from home, so alone and isolated, already I was so homesick that I wanted to cry. I hadn't realized how much comfort I had taken from the fact that, even if I was nothing but a prisoner back in Salt Lake, I was within a few miles of my home. I always had the hope that someone might stumble upon our camp and save me, that there were still some people looking for me, that somewhere I might be recognized and rescued. At one point, according to Mitchell at least, there had been a huge effort to find me. Maybe there's a little bit of that still going on. Maybe I would still get lucky. But I knew that was infinitely less likely now that I was in California. No one knew me here. No one would recognize my face. I might as well have been riding the train to another planet. After stumbling off the metro at the last station, Mitchell studied a map that showed the bus routes and got us on the right bus out to Lakeside. We bounced along for a while. Only a few passengers were on the bus. All of us were quiet. Climbing off the bus, I took a look around. Lakeside, California, my new home. I didn't know it yet, but I was about to enter a new phase of my capture. Mitchell had never really cared if I was fed or cold or hungry, but he was about to set a new standard in neglect and abuse. Lean days were coming. I was about to find out what real hunger was. I stood on the road where the bus had dropped us off, and I took in my new surroundings as best I could through my stupid veil. I'd expected to see a beautiful mountain lake surrounded by pine trees and white aspen. That was hardly the case. What I saw was a small, man-made pond with a stubby boardwalk wrapped around it, a few ducks, a single black swan, a couple of people out for a walk. And we were hardly in the forest. Across the lake there was an old convenience store. Wrigley's was its name. Next to Wrigley's was a liquor store. Great. That was going to make Mitchell really happy. Later on, I would find that the small town had a tiny library and an old grocery store that was run by a Muslim man who was always very friendly. I don't think he ever let Mitchell plunder like the guy back in Salt Lake did, but he was always kind to me, and he let us scavenge in the garbage for food. And he sold handmade tortillas. When Mitchell was flush with cash, meaning he had a couple dollars that he hadn't spent on booze, we'd go into the grocery store and buy some of his warm tortillas. I'd spread a little butter across the top and sprinkle on some sugar. I thought it was one of the best things I had ever tasted. Lakeside had a couple fast food places and a little farther down the street, a much larger grocery store named Vaughn's. And there was a small Protestant church. What a godsend. The people who ran the church were simply angels. Once they gave me some frozen tortillas, I was so hungry, I gulped them down like some kind of flatbread popsicle. More important, behind their building, they had placed a worn-out plastic crate in which they left old bread they had gathered up from the local grocery stores so that people like me could have something to eat. The first day, we walked over to the pond, our green sacks over our backs. We placed our belongings on the ground. Then Mitchell turned to us and said, "I need to go find a place for us to live. Hepzibah, you stay and keep an eye on Esther." I remember watching him head off. How long is this going to take, I wondered. An hour? 10 hours? A couple of days? How does one show up in a new city, homeless and without any food or money, and find a place to live? I settled onto the dry mud near the pond to wait, figuring it would be a while. It was a sunny day, warm and pleasant, and I was content to sit on the ground and watch the people go by. I didn't have to wait very long. Maybe 20 minutes later, Mitchell came back. Seeing him walking toward us, I expected him to announce that this wasn't the place and that God had commanded him to move on. But as he got closer, I could see he was excited. "I have found the perfect place," he announced. We gathered up the green bags and started trudging after him. As always, I was walking in the middle, with Mitchell ahead of me, Barzee just a few feet behind me. We headed up a hill and crossed the highway. We walked past the El Capitan High School, past the school sports fields, and then a BMX bike park. There we came to an old sand levee with a spillway. Everything was covered with so much dust it almost made it hard to breathe. Mitchell ducked into some wispy willow trees that covered the steep embankment. The trees were so old, I couldn't tell if they were alive or dead. Cracked with age, their dry branches hanging down like bony fingers, they appeared to be completely leafless. Instead, they were covered with little hanging brown things that looked like worms. I reached out to touch one, and it crumpled at my touch. It seemed that half of the wormy things fell off the trees as we walked under them, filling my hair with brown chalk. I felt like I had entered the fire swamp from The Princess Bride. This might be the only place on earth that has never seen any water, I thought, already feeling homesick for our camp back in the mountains. Mitchell led the way across the levee, then pushed us up the other side of the embankment where the ground was flat. More dead trees, more of the fire swamp. "Here," Mitchell said. It was incredibly discouraging to see the place that he had picked. There were so many branches, old logs and twigs, that I didn't know how he could possibly expect us to find a place to set up camp. But Mitchell was acting like a schoolboy at recess, smiling and so excited about our new hideout. He went to work, clearing an area of old branches and a million twigs, cutting away what he needed to in order to set up our tent. As he cut away the logs and branches, he piled them on the side of the campground that was nearest to the road, creating even more of a barrier to hide us. The road was only 20 or 30 yards away, but between the old trees and Mitchell's barricade, by the time he was finished, we were completely hidden. After clearing away the debris, Mitchell got out his trowel and started digging, chopping at the ground to level it. Then he laid out two tarps, placing them so that they were slightly overlapping. He wandered off into the brush looking for some branches that were not so brittle that they would snap in his hands. Dragging them back into the clearing, he started tying the branches together to make an arch. Then he made another. Once he had completed half a dozen arches, he drove them deeply into the ground. Then took out our largest tarp and draped it over the arches, creating a large tent that looked like a gray tunnel. He staked the tent into place. Even though the camp was bone dry, Mitchell knew the rains would come. So he rolled up the edges of the tarps and jammed small sticks underneath them to form a lip just inside of the overhanging tarp. Then he dug a narrow trench around the outside of the tent to funnel the water away. Finally, he cut our last tarp in half and hung a piece at both ends of the tunnel. Straightening up, he studied his work. Our new home was complete. After clearing another space, he began to set up his own tent. When he was finished, he stood back and proclaimed his new temple. "This will be the altar of Emmanuel," he said.
The altar of Emmanuel? Wow, what was I supposed to think? Sounded like something out of a comic book. It was creepy and sacrilegious. It was arrogant and misogynistic, and it made my skin crawl.
I noticed him steal a quick look at Barzee. She glared at him and nodded. "Now that we have a new home, it's time to make some other changes," he announced. From now on, we're going to stick to a schedule.
Apparently, Barzi was angry, again.
That he was constantly coming after me and ignoring her. Feeling forgotten and resentful, she demanded that something change. No one asked me, or I would have desperately insisted that he should focus all of his attentions on Barzi. Cut me off completely. I'd have been the happiest person in the world. But no one asked me, and that wasn't Mitchell's intention. Knowing he had to do something to pacify Barzi's wrath, he had come up with a plan.
You're going to start taking turns sleeping with me in the altar of Emmanuel, he said.
I only have to sleep with you half the time now, I thought. It was the greatest thing I'd heard since the night I'd been taken. And that's what we did. For about 2 days. Then, to my utter disgust and disappointment, our schedule quickly migrated to where Barzi was his in the daytime and I was his at night. But Mitchell was gone most of the day. Then, after a long day of plundering, ministering, and drinking in San Diego, he'd come home just in time to lead me to his altar, leaving Barzi simmering outside. After a few weeks of this, Barzi demanded another change in the schedule. Mitchell promised to do better, but nothing ever changed. One way or the other, I was always in the altar, and Barzi was always left outside. A day or two after arriving in Lakeside, we went to the local Walmart. Barzi and I were wrapped up in our robes and covered with our veils. Mitchell bought a few things and stole a few others, bedding, cheap pale green comforters, and flannel sheets that were decorated with the image of a moose. Across the highway from our new home was a small park where people would come to fly their model airplanes. Between the park and our hideout was an open patch of dirt with tons of cacti. One day, Mitchell came back from his wanderings with a few prickly pears he had picked in the open field. Vicious little things, with tiny sliver needles that would stick painfully in your skin. They ranged in color from deep purple to yellowy orange. None of us had ever eaten one before, so it took a little bit of careful prodding before we figured out how to cut them open and extract the fruit. The meat was slimy and filled with tiny seeds. I watched as Mitchell took the first bite, hoping it was poison. He chewed and swallowed without falling over. Bummer. But at least we had something to eat. He cut a piece for me, and I ate it. It wasn't really good, but it wasn't terrible. For a long time, I tried to extract all the tiny seeds and spit them out, but there were so many of them, I eventually gave up and just ate them. I turned to look at the field. It was full of prickly pears, but we didn't know how long the season would last, so Mitchell went out and picked as many as he could. Once I became accustomed to the slimy fruit and got over my objection to eating the seeds, I actually came to like them. We ate them a plateful at a time, and over the next few months, they turned out to be the main staple of our diet. The only problem was, no matter how careful I was not to touch the outer skin, it seemed like I spent half the day picking tiny slivers out of my hands. Once we got set up in our new home, Mitchell really hunkered down. It became obvious that even though we were a long way from my home, and it appeared that no one was looking for me in California, the episode at the library had changed him. He was cautious, to the point of being paranoid. Because of this, Barzi and I were only allowed out of our hideaway once a week. One day a week to leave my hot and dusty prison. One day a week to get away from the smell of blue plastic and warm water. One day a week to see someone besides my prison guards. My routine was very simple. Boredom, hunger, rape. Sometimes Mitchell would bring us food, but it was sporadic and unpredictable. Soon I was living with the pangs of hunger all the time. I loved going out, not because I had any hope of being rescued, but because I was desperately bored. Day after day, I sat and dreamed of getting out of the blue tent. I dreamed of getting out of the fire swamp, of seeing anyone besides Mitchell and Barzi. I desperately needed to be reminded that there was a real world out there,
And even if I couldn't be a part of it, even if I couldn't do anything more than pass through it like a white-robed ghost that no one was willing to acknowledge, anything was better than sitting underneath a blue tarp day after day. On some of the days that I was allowed out of the fire swamp, we would sit and watch the high school kids out on the sports fields. That should be me, I thought as I watched in misery. But even though it was hard to watch the other kids, being in the world seemed to make me feel better. It reminded me that it was still there, and it rekindled the hope that one day I might actually be a part of it, not just someone who had to watch it from behind a veil. Shortly after we arrived in California, Mitchell announced that our drinking days were over. Not a chance, I thought, and I was right. I don't think he went more than a day without drinking. It turned out that what he really meant to announce was that Barzee's drinking days were over. Every day he would go out and come back with a bottle of vodka, gin, or rum, but he always drank it by himself. Barzee felt this was ridiculously unfair, so she confronted him. You're either going to give up alcohol like you said we were, or you bring home enough for all of us, she demanded. There was no more pretense, no more submissiveness or piety. She wanted to get drunk, and she wanted to get drunk all the time. Which showed that things had changed. There wasn't as much talk about being God's holy servants. Not as much talk about descending below all things in order to rise above all the sins of the world. Not that either of them had given up on the religion thing. The only subjects we ever talked about were religion, the impending end of the world, Mitchell being the Davidic king, and Barzee's guaranteed place in heaven. But I think both of them just felt there wasn't as much need of pretending as there had been when we were living back in Utah. A couple of nights later, Mitchell came home with a bag of Kentucky Fried Chicken and a 12-pack of Steel Reserve 16-ounce beers. I was about to find out that the beer in California was a lot stronger than the beer in Utah was. We started passing around the chicken and the beer. Mitchell forced me to drink, making sure I swallowed every ounce of my beer. Then he passed me another can. I was already thinking that I was going to throw up. Meanwhile, he and Barzee were having a jolly time. Beer and KFC, the perfect night. I sipped, hating every swallow. Mitchell kept forcing me to swallow more. By the end of the second can, I was in really bad shape. He handed me another beer. I knew there was no way I was going to get any of it down. I stumbled to the ground and crawled off to the corner of the tarp. I laid there, listening to Mitchell and Barzee talking about how much more they liked California beer. They didn't even seem to notice that I was lying on the ground. After a while, Mitchell finally looked at me. Seeing I was sick, he threw me a metal bowl. I held it to my face. The metal was cool against my skin. It felt good. I waited, fighting to hold my stomach down. Mitchell must have decided either that I wasn't going to throw up or that he didn't want to get the bowl dirty because he came over and took the bowl away. Almost immediately, I started throwing up. I retched so long and hard that I thought I was going to die. Then I passed out. I woke up late the next morning, face down in my own vomit. It was the most horrible and disgusting feeling I had ever felt. As a young Mormon girl from Salt Lake City, a young girl who had promised herself that she would never even taste alcohol, I never imagined that I would find myself in such a degrading situation. If Mitchell wanted me to descend below all things, then surely I had done that. I was sick and devastated. Words can't explain how humiliated and disgusted I felt. I used what little water we had to wash myself up. Mitchell laughed at me as he watched me trying to clean myself off. You know, this is symbolic of where you are spiritually, he mocked with glee. My little Esther, face down in her own vomit. That is where you are now.
For the next couple of months, Mitchell would go into San Diego and minister almost every day. I don't know what he did with the money. I just know he never brought any of it home. He must have spent all of it on cigarettes and alcohol, because when he came back, he always stank of both. I do know that he didn't spend any of his money on food. The only thing we ate for months was the prickly pears, old bread from behind the church, and whatever food we pulled out of dumpsters and garbage cans. My mother always taught me that we needed to finish everything on our plates before we left the table. But I have to say that I am grateful for those people who threw away their food. Their scraps helped to sustain me for many months. Chapter 28, Thanksgiving. Time moved forward, one painful day at a time. Late summer melted into fall. The weather in Lakeside was generally pleasant, and I could see the wisdom in having left the mountains of Utah, which I knew would already be draped in snow. But I felt homesick in California. I hated being so far from my home, and everything about our camp had an eerie feeling about it. The dead trees, the dust and cacti, the brown things that were hanging from all the branches. And I thought that it was odd that we were living just a few feet off the main road and only a short walk from a large high school in the center of town. Yet no one seemed to know we were there, or if they did, they didn't care. As the days grew shorter, I realized that the change of seasons was underway. I thought back on the night I had been taken, June 4th. It had been the beginning of the summer. I was young enough that 3 months of vacation felt like a very long time. I was looking forward to endless days of swimming with my cousins and jumping on the trampoline and summer parties with my family and celebrations on the 4th of July. All of it seemed so long ago. Another world, another girl. As Thanksgiving approached, I tried desperately not to think about my family. The only thing I thought about was that we might find a good meal. Thanksgiving dawned, gray, but warm. Feeling magnanimous, Mitchell agreed to take us into the city. We got dressed in our robes and veils, then took the metro downtown. But we didn't go all the way into the city. Instead, we stopped at a metro stop on the outskirts of town. Mitchell had already scouted out our Thanksgiving meal. The hometown buffet was offering a free meal for the homeless and the down and out. It was a traditional holiday meal, turkey, potatoes, gravy, and dressing. I have never enjoyed a meal as much as the one I ate on the vinyl seats stuffed between other homeless people at the hometown buffet. For dessert, we took the metro to Lemon Grove and walked a short distance to the grocery store named Dave's. They sold a lot of health foods. Images of the health food store in Salt Lake City flashed through my mind. And were famous for their pies. Mitchell went in and bought a pumpkin pie for us to share. It was such a treat. Then we took the metro into San Diego and started wandering the streets. We didn't have anywhere to go, so we weren't in a hurry. And I was very glad to be out from underneath the blue tarp. We were walking along the boardwalk, the kind of place that families and tourists like to go, when I saw an old couple walking hand in hand. They smiled at each other and spoke in the short sentences that made it clear that they understood each other well. I couldn't help but stare at them. They seemed so happy, so in love, so normal. I wondered what their story was. How had they fallen in love? How many children did they have? Had they always been as happy as they seemed to be now? A blanket of sadness hit me, settling deep into my soul. I'm never going to have such happiness, I thought. I'll never have such a life. I'm nothing but a slave to these two people who are keeping me so close. By the time I can get away from them, it will be too late. No one will ever want me. I will be too old. And after all the things that have happened to me, no one will be willing to give me a chance. I'll never have a real husband. I'll never have any children of my own. Depressed by such thoughts, I put my head down and followed Mitchell. We walked downtown.
It seemed like we ran into a lot of homeless people. I don't know why. Maybe they were out for free meals, or maybe Mitchell just had a way of attracting his kind of people.
You know about the truck that's going to bring Thanksgiving dinner? A homeless man said to Mitchell.
We didn't know. The old man told him.
Mitchell was thrilled. More free food!
He got the address and we started walking. Sure enough, not long after we got there, a large pickup truck with lots of silver containers in the bed showed up. But they weren't organized, there were no policemen or security, and it quickly turned into pandemonium. Screaming, shoving, arguments that escalated into fights. People scrambling over turkeys, tearing them apart with their bare hands while others grabbed entire containers of food and ran. By the time we worked our way through the mayhem to the truck, the only thing that remained was a bunch of empty trays. I could still smell the fragrance of cooked turkey in the air. I could see white lines of mashed potatoes that had been spilled on the ground, kernels of corn that had been scattered everywhere. I was crushed. I had been so hungry for so long and for so often, the thought of a wasted meal was something that was hard for me to take. It was starting to get dark. With no food to eat and with nothing else to do, Mitchell and Barzee shepherded me back to camp. That night, I lay atop my makeshift bed and thought, "It's Thanksgiving. You're supposed to count your blessings." But did I have anything to be thankful for? I wondered. At first, I didn't think so. Then I started to make a list. I still believed in God. I knew He was the Savior of the world, and I knew that He was near. I felt His presence every day. He was the only reason I had been able to keep my sanity. He kept me strong and gave me hope. Nothing that Mitchell could ever do to me could take away my faith. Yes, that was something to be thankful for. I still had a family. I didn't get to be with them, but someday I thought I would. Another reason to be grateful. I was hungry, but I was healthy, and though I didn't get any dinner, I had been able to eat lunch at Hometown Buffet, which had turned out to be a really great meal. Millions of people around the world hadn't eaten anything all day. My list went on. One day, I would be able to get away from my tormentors. One day, I would be free. The gray tent kept the sun off. The trees around our camp kept the wind at bay. I kept adding to my list of blessings until I eventually fell asleep. Chapter 29. Another Girl. One day in late November, long after we had settled into a routine, Mitchell returned from ministering. He had that kind of evil look that I had come to know so well. Lustful, entitled, excited.
"The time has come," he announced. "The Lord has prepared us. We are ready. I must go forth and obtain another wife."
My stomach dropped into my lap, and I felt the blood begin to pound in my head. Another wife. Another victim. The thought made me want to scream. Mitchell looked at me, waiting to see how I'd react. I stared at him in shock. What did he expect me to do? Smile and clap my hands? Agree with him? Encourage him? Did he think that I was like Barzee? Did he think that I was going to say it was okay? I couldn't meet his eyes. I was so angry. And in that moment, he knew he couldn't trust me, which was perfectly fine with me. I hated this man. He was the devil. I didn't want to be trusted by him. All of us were silent for a moment. Clearly, this was news to Barzee, but she didn't react. I thought it was incredible. It was as if Mitchell had come home and announced that he was going shopping.
"Hey, I think it's time I got a new robe. Hey, I think it's time I got a new wife."
It seemed to be about the same thing to her. He watched me carefully, seeing the anger in my eyes, then went on.
"She has to be a Mormon, and young, and pure. I want her to be like you, Sheer Jashub."
I cringed at the name. They had started calling me Shirjasha again shortly after we'd moved to California. They knew I hated it, but they thought it would help me forget my old life and my home.
I'm going to visit all the Mormon churches in El Cajon until I find her, Mitchell concluded. Then, I'll have to find out where she lives. Meanwhile, we'll prepare the same as we prepared for you, Shir Jashub. You might prepare. I won't prepare a thing, I thought.
Why do you have to go all the way to El Cajon to find a wife? I asked. Mitchell looked at me as if I was stupid.
First of all, it needs to be far enough away that none of the searchers will stumble into our camp. Second, there probably aren't any LDS churches any closer than that. Like I said, she has got to be a Mormon. So that is where I will go.
The next Sunday, he got ready to go hunting. I remember watching him search through the fire swamp for normal clothes that he could wear. Apparently, God could command him to move mountains, part the seas, or call down fire from heaven, but he couldn't help to hide his identity when he sent his servant out to steal a new wife. That being the case, Mitchell knew he couldn't be kidnapping girls in his white robes. He would be way too easy to remember, way too easy to identify. And it wouldn't do to show up in church dressed as an ancient prophet. Mormons weren't going to go for such a thing. So he searched through our meager belongings for something normal that he could wear. Over the past couple months, as Mitchell had wandered here and there around the city, he had stumbled on several deserted homeless camps. Rummaging through the junk and clothes that had been left behind, he had salvaged a few moldy blankets to hang in the trees around our camp. Most of the little wormy things had fallen off the trees, and we weren't hidden as well as Mitchell had wanted us to be. Along with the blankets, Mitchell had scavenged some ragged khaki pants and an old purple shirt that was so faded it was the same color as the pants. Mitchell came out of the altar of Emmanuel with his new clothes on. He had cleaned himself up as best he could, tying his hair into a ponytail and twisting his beard into a braid that was wrapped tightly up to his chin. I watched as he checked his clothes. Then he pulled the blanket back and walked out of the camp. All day long I waited for him to come back. My mind was in a panic, horrible thoughts racing through my brain. What will I do if he comes back with another young girl? What will I do when he tries to rape her? Will I be able to stop him? Will I be able to stand up to him and Barzee? Will the girl trust me? Will we be able to escape together? Then I had the most sickening thought of all. What if I don't do anything? What if I just step aside and let him do to her what he did to me? I couldn't stop the horrible thoughts going through my mind. By the time the sun went down, I was so sick with worry and lack of food that I almost didn't have the strength to stand. A couple hours after sunset, we finally heard the sound of someone winding through the fire swamp. The blankets were pushed aside and Mitchell was standing there. I immediately recognized the smug look on his face. He sat down to tell his story.
I got to El Cajon and headed to the Mormon chapel. To my disappointment, the first congregation I went to was a Spanish-speaking group, and there were no young girls among them anyway. So I waited around until the next congregation came to the building.
Mormon congregations are able to share the same buildings by starting their worship services at different times.
I went into the church and kind of looked around, like I was lost and lonely. Some people came up to talk to me. They invited me to the men's study group. All through the lesson, I almost had to laugh. They were treating me like I didn't know anything, when I am the Davidic king, the Lord's prophet here on earth. What did they think they could teach me? Once that was over, I headed with the rest of the crowd to Sunday school, where the lesson was on Daniel in the lion's den. The silly little Mormon missionaries kept trying to pull me out of Sunday school to attend their special class, but I told them I wanted to keep learning about Daniel. Those young fools, what do they know about anything? I do think, however, that the lesson was inspired. Is there any doubt that I was just like Daniel in the lion's den? There I was, all of these wicked souls around me, all of these wicked and nasty people who would have torn me apart had they known what I intended to do to one of their children. Finally, we went into sacrament meeting, but again, I was disappointed. There was no acceptable young girls in sight. I started to think that maybe it was not the time yet. Maybe the Lord was just testing my faithfulness. Maybe it was a test like Abraham and Isaac. After the meeting was over, I was walking through the parking lot when a car pulled over and the window rolled down. A man who had sat by me in one of the meetings stuck his head out and invited me to come home to have dinner with his family. You should have seen the meal. It was beautiful. Chicken covered in almonds and sauce, green beans, mashed potatoes, and dessert. Mitchell stopped to look at us and gloat. He licked his lips for effect. It was delicious, he said. I turned and looked at Barzi. She was furious, and so was I. Here we were, trapped in the fire swamp for weeks, sitting on buckets and homemade chairs surrounded by filthy, smelly blankets and creepy overhanging trees. We had not eaten all day. We'd been eating poorly for months. The thought of a home-cooked meal sounded like a miracle to us. Barzi swallowed her anger, and neither of us said anything. Mitchell went on in his self-righteous voice, the voice he used after he had just talked to God. I learned that they have a daughter. She will be my next wife. Barzi stared at him in rage. You ate without bringing us any food? She hissed. I shook my head at the bitter irony. Her husband had just told her that he had found another wife, and the only thing that she could think about was the fact that he had eaten without bringing her any food. Mitchell looked at the ground in fake humility. The Lord blesses those of us who are faithful, and because I was faithful, he revealed that their daughter was to be my next wife. Then, after I had received this revelation, the Lord gave me his approval by providing a sumptuous feast. Barzi lifted her fist and cried, Do you think nothing of me? You go out and stuff your face full of food, and then you come back and gloat about how good it was when you know I haven't eaten anything all day. I had nothing to eat yesterday. That's 2 days without food. We've been eating like mice for months now, and you gloat because you got a home-cooked meal? Mitchell smiled and moved toward her. He was so used to manipulating her, and she was so willing to be manipulated that he knew exactly what to say. Hepzibah, I love you. I always think of you. But the Lord has placed a heavy mantle upon me, even through my weaknesses. But then the Lord, in his great bounty, blesses me because he knows that I struggle under this great burden. To lighten my heavy load, he bestows great gifts upon me. The feast that I have eaten is one of those gifts, but it was also a sign that I have chosen correctly. All of these things were signs from God. It was like when the angel came to Joseph and told him that Mary was a beloved virgin and that he should still wed her. Listening to him, I wanted to puke. Blech was the only thought that was going through my head. After he calmed Barzi and after she had composed herself again, they pulled out their handmade calendar and started to go through the days, seeking revelation as to when he should go forth again. They talked for a few minutes and then Mitchell announced, January 4th. They spent the next few weeks piling more branches and brush around our camp to conceal us a little better, obtaining an egg carton case for the victim to sleep on and a few other things that were needed to get ready for the new wife. I wondered if he was going to cable her up like he had done to me, but Mitchell explained that he had reached the next level of faith and righteousness. Having reached this plateau of virtue, he'd be able to keep her in the camp by his pure force of will. I was left out of the preparations. Clearly, they didn't trust me, which made me very happy, No way was I going to help them. No way was I going to be a part of this. I would have felt like a cannibal, preparing the fire for cooking their next meal, if I had been forced to help them in their preparations for this despicable act.
Chapter 30. Throw Away My Christmas.
Mitchell spent most of the next few weeks preparing for his new captive. It was all he thought about, all he talked about, the only thing on his mind. It drove me crazy how he always referred to her as his new wife. She isn't a wife. She is a casualty, I wanted to scream. Watching him, I was reminded again that the evil inside him would never be satisfied. He was fire. There was no water. As long as he was living, he would always want more. Someone new, someone younger, someone more beautiful. December rolled along, and pretty soon it was almost Christmas. For being such deeply religious people, Mitchell and Barzee didn't seem that excited about the birth of Jesus Christ. They did, however, view it as another chance for a good meal. Christmas morning dawned, cold and gray. Mitchell knew there'd be lots of people lined up for Christmas dinner, so we headed down to San Diego early. After stepping off the metro, we walked to the large convention center. It looked like every homeless person in the city had come for Christmas dinner. The line stretched out of the building and down the block. We got in the line and waited. Thinking of the food, my stomach started growling. I was weak from hunger. I had been hungry since our arrival in California. It never did warm up, and by the time we got into the building, I was tired and cold. We continued moving along the line and eventually ended up in a large convention hall. We were greeted by one of the volunteers who told us to sit down at one of the long tables. Looking around, I realized that most of the helpers were young women, many of them about my age. It was one of those moments that really struck me, sending a pain into my heart. What has happened to me? I thought. What has happened to my life? That should be me. I should be one of those girls who are serving the food, not sitting here at the table, waiting to be served. I'm not really homeless. I have a family. They love me. They miss me. They want me back. I was glad that I had my veil, for it helped to hide the tear that was sliding down my cheek. A couple of the young women brought us our food. I was so hungry. I was so grateful. It was the best thing I had eaten since our homeless Thanksgiving meal. I ate until I was full, then watched Mitchell wolf his food down. He cleaned off his plate, scooping up every drop of gravy, then asked for more. I was kind of embarrassed, but Mitchell didn't care. After dinner, we started walking around downtown. The streets were almost deserted, and we didn't really have anywhere to go. I didn't care. I was just grateful to be out of the fire swamp. Rounding a corner, a young black man came up to us. "Merry Christmas," he said as he handed each of us a small, handheld radio. Mine was pink with matching headphones. He smiled at me, then walked away. I looked down at my radio. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was the best present I had ever been given. Nearly overcome with joy, I put the earphones in my ears and turned the dial, searching for some music that I would recognize, something that would connect me to my former life. I found a station that was playing Christmas carols, Karen Carpenter's Merry Christmas, Darling, and then Winter Wonderland. Both of the songs reminded me of my mom. Listening to the holiday music, I realized that the seasons had changed without me. The world had gone on. Things had changed. My school friends had gone on without me. Life had continued on without me. But still, I was so happy to have the music. I wanted to sing along, but I knew I couldn't. Mitchell would hate that, so I listened and enjoyed in silence. Then I heard Mitchell's voice above the sound of the music in my headphones. "This world is so wicked," he spoke so loudly I couldn't tune him out. "This world is so wicked, and Hollywood is the worst. Singers and movie stars are the greatest tool of the devil. We must learn to tune them out. Tune them out of our lives, out of our ears. We must learn to keep ourselves pure from their evil influence. How can we put God in our hearts if we put the devil in our ears?" I tried desperately to ignore him. I knew he was talking to me, but I didn't care. It was Christmas music, for heaven's sake! How evil could that be?
He moved closer to me and raised his voice.
Sure, their songs are easy, and they may seem to make us happy, but they will grease our way to hell. They will kill and defile us. They will bring evil into our hearts. We have to deny them, don't we, Sheer Jashub?
On and on he went. It was like listening to fingernails scratching down a chalkboard. He wouldn't shut up. He was like a whiny preacher intent on saving a sinful soul.
Those who enjoy the sounds of Hollywood are enjoying the sounds of hell.
He jumped ahead of me to stand in my way, staring at me and not letting me pass. I returned his hard gaze, refusing to look away. For a moment, there was an unseen battle between us, a battle of souls and will.
You will do as I tell you,
his eyes seemed to say. I stared back at him.
I will do it for now, but not forever. One day, I will defeat you. One day, I'm going to win.
He seemed to grow a little darker, his lips tighter, his shoulders square.
I will always be the master. You will always be the slave.
I dared to defy him only a moment longer before I had to look away. I closed my eyes in sadness and frustration. As much as I wanted to just listen to the music, it wasn't worth it. As much as I wanted to hear the beautiful sounds and enjoy the wonderful spirit that the songs of Christmas brought, I knew it was impossible. Mitchell wasn't going to let me. He was going to make it more miserable to have the music than to not have it now. There was only one way to make him stop. I took the headphones off and threw the radio away. Mitchell watched me, then smiled an evil grin. We walked half a block in silence. Then he took out his own radio, put the earphones in his ears, and started listening to the same music I had been listening to. I wanted to scream in frustration. I felt so betrayed. I felt so cheated. Barzee only laughed at me. She thought that I was such a fool. But at least Mitchell was not talking any longer. We continued walking around San Diego. A couple blocks later, I saw a young man, about my age, who was wearing a long-sleeved striped shirt, khaki shorts and flip-flops. He wore dark sunglasses and had light brown hair. I watched him for a moment. That was the only good thing about having to wear a veil. No one could tell if you were looking at them. As I watched, I started thinking. I had never had a boyfriend. I had hardly even talked to boys, and though I was extremely shy, I had always looked forward to dating and having boyfriends. Like all young girls, I had dreamed of getting a new outfit and getting all dolled up with my hair and curls and having makeup on. How exciting it would be to have a boy walk up to the front door with a bouquet of flowers just for me. What if, kept running through my mind. About that time, we walked past a shop called Hustler. Mitchell tried the door, but it was locked. Disappointed, he turned and led us back to the fire swamp.
Chapter 31. Waiting for Disaster.
Mitchell was nothing if not bold. I was constantly amazed by how brazen he was about the next kidnapping he was planning. He showed not a moment of fear or hesitation. If he ever thought he might get caught, he never showed it. And why should he? He had taken me. He had been able to hide me just a few miles from my home. He'd been able to manipulate and lie his way out of every situation. Nothing in his experience gave him much reason to be afraid. January 4th, day of the appointed kidnapping, finally arrived. When I woke up that morning, I felt like Judgment Day had come. But then I realized that this was worse. This wasn't a day to judge the guilty. This was a day for the innocent to get hurt. Mitchell went through his normal routine, all the time trying to hide his excitement. Just like on the day he had prepared to go down to take my cousin,
He put on an air of heaviness and persecution. So hard to be a prophet, such a burden to carry out the work of the Lord, so difficult to be the chosen. Glancing at Barzee, he tried to display a bit of sadness or hesitation, but none of it was real. He was nothing but excited. He was like an animal that was overcome by the smell of blood. He was driven by lust and nothing else. He spent the day checking and double-checking the things he would need to capture his next victim. Then he made an announcement. My next wife will be called Maher Shalal Hashbaz Rebecca Isaiah, he said. Holy cow, I thought. That's a worse name than Shujashub. Maher Shalal Hashbaz was the son of Isaiah, he explained. Another boy's name for your new wife, I wanted to say. What is going on inside your head? It means plunder speedeth, spoil hasteth. No, it only means you're stupid. Mitchell waited as if he expected some kind of adulation for his excellent choice of names. Barzee didn't say anything. I just shook my head. Late that afternoon, Mitchell got dressed in the same clothes he had worn when he had gone to church on that Sunday morning back in November to identify his next victim. But he also spent a long time packing the disgusting green bags, dark clothes, rope, duct tape, his long knife. Fingering the knife, he turned to me and smiled. Shujashub, do you remember this? He asked with a sickening laugh, his voice low and guttural. Of course I recognized the knife. How many times had he flashed it as he threatened me? How many times had he stroked its edge as he reminded me what he was going to do to my family? Do you remember what I said to you the night I brought you away from your family? Of course I remembered what he had said. I have a knife at your neck. Don't make a sound. Get up and come with me. They were the most terrifying words that I had ever heard. He looked at me. I looked at him. He slipped the knife into his bag. Evening was coming on and it was starting to get dark. A night breeze began to blow and the willows bent and swayed, their bony fingers lifting with the wind. It was a hot wind. Dry. I wiped a bit of sand out of my eyes. Mitchell waited a few more minutes for darkness to completely settle. Then, sighing wearily, got up and said goodbye. Barzee and I settled down to do what we did most of the time now, which was wait. The evening passed so slowly. Then the night. It was very dark. I remember the moon and the stars were obscured by dust and clouds. We went to bed. I didn't sleep. Hours passed. My stomach never settled. I was sick with dread. Then, very early in the morning, maybe just an hour or so before sunrise, we heard footsteps coming toward us. My heart beat wildly for a moment. What if Mitchell had been captured? What if he had told the police about me? What if I was being rescued? The curtain parted, and we saw Mitchell standing in the darkness. I quickly looked behind him. No one else was there. It is not time, he said to announce his failure. I almost laughed with joy. He had failed. He did not get her. I was giddy with relief. Just like with Abraham and Isaac, it was a trial of our faith, he explained. Barzee stood beside the tent, her face barely illuminated in the darkness. To me, she looked disappointed. She seemed to move toward him, but he walked past her and sat down. He placed his green bags on the ground and started pulling out some food. I was amazed. Every time I had food now, it felt like it was manna from heaven. He placed a few sandwiches on the tarp. They were small and smashed from being stuffed in his bags. Looking at them, I knew they weren't going to satisfy my hunger, but still, I was grateful for anything to eat. Barzee and I made a beeline for the food and started eating hungrily. While we ate, Mitchell talked. I made it to El Cajon and walked slowly to where she lives. It was very late by the time I got there.
I circled around the house, looking for a way in. No open windows, no unlocked doors. But I continued searching, knowing that God would provide a way. Finally, I found a sliding door around the back that was unlocked. I started to slide the door back. When I had opened it just a crack, I stopped to listen. I thought I heard something inside. I listened for a few seconds, but it was gone. Slowly, I continued to slide the door back. Once again, I heard the sound, a low rustle. I didn't know what it was, but it went away again. I pushed the door back all the way and started to step inside. Suddenly, I froze. I realized what I was hearing. Snoring. A man was in the room, and he had to be a large man from the loud noise that he made. I realized I would never be able to find my new wife and get her past her father. So, knowing that God must have another plan, and terrified at the thought of encountering a man much larger than you are, I thought, I turned around and ran. But I didn't want to come back empty-handed. I wanted you to know that I always think about you. So I stopped by an all-night grocery store, dug around to find enough change to buy some ham and mayo, then stopped by the church and got the last loaf of bread out of the box they keep in back. He stopped and pointed proudly at the sandwiches. I noticed there was not nearly a loaf of bread's worth of sandwiches left, which meant he hadn't stopped to get us food because he was worried about us. He had stopped to get food because he was hungry, and he'd eaten most of the sandwiches before he had come back to our camp. It is clear to me now, he concluded. California was supposed to be a test of our faithfulness, but the Lord has other plans in store for me now. God, plan, test of faithfulness? The whole thing was absurd. God wasn't testing his faith. There was no plan. There was no divine guidance or heavenly intervention. Mitchell was a dirty old man who wanted another child to satisfy him. That's the only thing this was about. He knew it. Barzee knew it. There was no godly mystery here. Still, I didn't say anything. I was way beyond ever trying to talk to him, let alone ever trying to argue with him. God bless that little girl, was all I thought. Chapter 32 High Camp and Hustler. For the next 2 weeks, we did pretty much nothing but sit around being bored and hungry. I was only allowed to leave the fire swamp once a week. It was a miserable time. Mitchell always talking, Barzee always whining about being confined to the camp, a constant hot wind, the creepy trees above us, the musky smell of old blankets around us. I felt like I had been completely forgotten by the outside world. Then, one day, someone walked into our camp. It was late afternoon. All of us were sitting outside our tents when I heard the crunch of footsteps coming toward us. I scampered toward one of the musty blankets we used for a barrier and pushed the corner aside. Mitchell was immediately at my side, his bad breath on my neck. A lone man was walking through the fire swamp toward us. Mitchell immediately pulled me back, almost pushing me to the ground. He dragged me back to the tent and hissed for me to sit down. Barzee followed, her face tight with fear. Mitchell made a lot of noise rummaging through his gear. It only took a few seconds to find the knife and pull it out. Barzee did what she always did, which was to stand around and wait for Mitchell to tell her what to do. Mitchell peered out of the gray tunnel, his lips growing tight. He was standing right over me, peering from behind the tarp. Because I was on the ground, his hands were level with my eyes, and I noticed that his knuckles were white. He shifted the knife in his hand to put it in a better position to strike, then crouched down. I don't know if the man heard Mitchell rummaging around, or if he saw the blankets that were hanging in the trees and thought he'd check it out, but for whatever reason, he started walking toward our camp. As the sound of footsteps got closer, Mitchell inched forward, ready to attack. I watched him intently. Is he going to kill him? I wondered in horror. The man came to a stop, Hey, he called out. Is anybody there?
Mitchell glared at me and lifted the knife, moving it in my direction. Anyone there? The man yelled again.
Mitchell put his fingers to his lips, then nodded at the knife, as if he had to remind me what he would do if I were foolish enough to scream.
Anyone home? The man repeated, though his voice was not as loud this time.
He waited, then started walking toward us again. We could clearly hear his footsteps across the leaves. He got closer, closer. Mitchell was as tight as a wire. He held the long knife at his side, ready to spring at the intruder. I wanted to scream. The man continued walking until he was just a few feet from the hanging blankets. I could see his shadow through the thin barricade. He lifted his arm. He was going to push the blankets aside. He was going to see us. Then he was going to die. Suddenly, the man stopped. He didn't move. He didn't say anything. All of us held our breath. No one dared to move. I don't know what it was that made him stop. Maybe he was afraid. Maybe he started listening to that intuition that's inside all of us, that little voice that sometimes guides us when there is danger. Maybe his guardian angel was with him that day. I don't know. I only know that Mitchell showed every indication of intending to kill him. He was coiled like a snake and ready to strike. But the man never took that last step. He didn't push the blankets aside. He never said another word. He stood there a long moment, the tension sucking all of the oxygen out of the air, then turned around and walked away. For a long time, none of us moved. "We have to find another place to live," Mitchell said. Mitchell was convinced that the Lord, in his great and manifest wisdom, had tried our faith and found us lacking. We were nowhere close to being worthy of accepting another wife, nowhere close to being worthy of his constant protection. We had been tried, and we had failed, which meant that something had to change. "There's a story in the Bible," he explained. "The children of Israel are surrounded by the Syrians. Evil people, really bad. They had a mighty army, a terrible and deadly scourge. But when the prophet Elisha stood up to face them, instead of seeing all the Syrian soldiers that surrounded them, he saw thousands of celestial soldiers that stood ready to defend the children of Israel. Chariots of fire, angels with their mighty swords. They that be with us are more than they that be with them," the prophet Elisha said. Mitchell stopped and looked at us. Barzi nodded as if it were the most inspiring thing she had ever heard. I looked at him as if it made no sense. "You don't see it, do you, Sir Jashub?" I shook my head. I didn't. "Just like with Elisha, the Lord could surround us with his angels. He could protect us so that no one would ever find us. But," he paused and looked at me, "he can't do it if you're not worthy." He turned and looked at Barzi. "He can't protect us if you're not humble. He can't bless me if your faith isn't strong enough. He can't hide us. He can't protect us. He is bound by your weak faith." He fell silent and thought a long moment. "We need to move to a more secure and hidden location. Tomorrow, we will go and find our new home." The next day, Mitchell made us dress in our street clothes, a bunch of filthy rags he had taken from the abandoned homeless camps. I wore a gray shirt and some oversized pants. Pulling them on, I felt so dirty. There I was, putting on a shirt that was so thin and filthy that a homeless man had thrown it away. That is what I had come to. I shook my head sadly and held my nose. Once we were dressed, we headed out. It was my first time in public without wearing a veil. I felt uncomfortable, vulnerable. I was surprised by how much I'd grown used to it, and I knew it made Mitchell nervous to have my face exposed, which made me nervous too. Mitchell, of course, led the way. I followed. Barzi followed me. But we took a completely different route from any we had ever taken when exiting the fire swamp before. Instead of crossing the riverbed and climbing the small embankment,
We turned left and crawled through a large irrigation pipe that crossed under the road. Emerging on the other side, Mitchell told us to be quiet and stay low while he checked it out. After a couple minutes of watching, he decided it was clear, and we headed out again, following the dry stream bed. We only went a couple of miles, but it seemed to take all day. It was hot and dry and dusty. When we couldn't go any farther, we climbed out of the ravine and found ourselves in an empty pasture. Again, Mitchell made us stay low while he took a look around. He was acting like a kid playing some kind of spy game, sneaking and creeping here and there. But I knew it wasn't a game. It was dangerous. And I knew he had his knife. While we waited, I sat down and put my hand into a patch of vibrant green plants. I felt instant pain shoot through my hand and immediately jumped up. The stinging nettle was vicious and my hands were quickly covered with red blisters. Barzee watched me, but showed no sympathy. "Spit on your hand," she instructed dryly. "Dogs and cats lick their wounds. You're no better than they are. You should do the same thing." I hated her reasoning, but figured she might be right. I spat and rubbed it in. I felt a little better, and Barzee seemed to puff a bit with pride. Mitchell crouched toward our hiding place and pointed to a mountain about half a mile away. We would have to sneak across the pastures and a narrow road to get there. Mitchell took off, leading the way, trying to appear as inconspicuous as possible, something that was ridiculously difficult to do. We made our way across the pasture and road and started climbing the small mountain. It proved to be much harder than it looked from the bottom of the hill. It was steep and thick with shrubs and covered with huge rocks. We climbed slowly. I was already weak from hunger. Mitchell pushed us on, always talking. Barzee had taken to not saying very much anymore. I don't know why. She was just quiet now. It was slow and difficult work to climb the mountain. We had to scramble over boulders, pulling ourselves up by thorny bushes before dropping down on the other side. We had to lift and pull and help to catch one another. Sometimes we had to slip between tiny cracks between the boulders. As we climbed, Mitchell would point out how various rocks reminded him of sexual body parts, and he would name the rocks with these names. We finally made it to the top, but there was no place to make our camp. Mitchell looked around, then told us to sit tight while he looked for a place to pitch our tents. He scrambled off and I sat down, hungry and weak with exhaustion. A little while later, he came slithering back, panting excitedly, exclaimed, "I found it! Come quickly, follow me!" We followed, fighting through scrub oaks and more boulders before dropping through a rock crevice that led to a small clearing. The north side of the clearing was backed by massive rocks that would be almost impossible to climb, and far too dangerous to drop down from the top. The other side of the clearing was walled in by scrub oaks and then a sheer cliff. The left and the right sides of the clearing were surrounded by prickly plants, scrub oak, and huge boulders. Mitchell walked proudly into the clearing. "Shir Jashub, Hepzibah, this is our new home." I looked around. It was a huge improvement from the fire swamp. But it was also so remote, so far from everything that it made me feel even more isolated from the world. "We will be safe here only if we are careful," Mitchell said. Then he stopped and looked at Barzee. "But we're going to have to act more wisely, which means you aren't going to be able to leave the camp anymore. You are going to have to stay up here with Shir Jashub until we are ready to move on." Barzee scowled. I expected her to argue, but she didn't say anything. That's just the way it was now. Mitchell had essentially made prisoners of us both. We hiked back to the lower camp, then spent all day packing up our gear, taking down our tents, and getting everything ready to move up to the new camp. Once it was dark, we started hauling things up to the top of the mountain. If I thought it was hard to climb the mountain in the daylight, it was nothing compared to hiking it at night, with a good part of our gear slung over my shoulders and my bedding in my arms. I was terrified that I might fall. If I had, I didn't think I'd have the energy to stand up again.
We finally stumbled into our new camp. Mitchell made us help him construct a new tunnel tent, and the moment it was finished, I crawled inside and immediately fell asleep. I only slept a few hours. When I woke up, the sun was a quarter way up in the sky. Mitchell figured it was a great time to do some exploring, so we spent the morning hiking around, checking out our new surroundings. At one point, we came upon a tight crevice underneath a huge boulder that formed a sliver of a cave. Mitchell told me to slither underneath and see what was inside. I lay down on my stomach and crawled into the narrow cave. I must be the first human who has ever been underneath this rock, I thought. Crawling a bit farther, I discovered I was wrong. A pair of old boots, a man's belt, and an old magazine were there. I wondered what would cause a man to take off his boots and belt. Then I picked up the magazine. Glancing at the cover, I let out a quick gasp and dropped it as if it were a spider. After all that I'd been through, I didn't think there was anything that could shock me anymore. But this was different. It was horrible. Mitchell had shown me pornography before, but he hadn't shown me anything like this. The horrible image was seared into my mind. Hearing me gasp, Mitchell slithered into the crevice and maneuvered to my side. He snatched up the magazine and began greedily looking at the pictures. Then he stopped and stared at me. "We have made the right decision. This place has been sanctified of the Lord. The Lord has seen fit to bless His servant with this sign." He then inched a little closer. "Sir Jashub, it's clear that your descent below all things is not complete. Who do you think you are to shrink from your brothers and sisters in this magazine? Do you think you are better than they are? Do you think you are more holy, more worthy of God's great love? It is clear that I must instruct you. When we get back to camp, I will." I shook my head in dread. His instructions were always painful lessons. My heart sank in fear. When we got back to our tents, he took the pornographic magazine and shoved it in my face. "Look at this," he screamed. I tried to fight him. I tried to close my eyes. But Mitchell grabbed my chin and turned my face toward the magazine. "Open your eyes or you'll regret it," he sneered. "These people are more righteous than you are. They're more righteous than the rest of the world." He turned the pages, making me look at everything. "These people are showing more courage than you have ever shown. They aren't afraid of showing their true spiritual state." I tried to look away, but he wouldn't let me, and it didn't matter. The images were already burned into my brain. I could never forget them. I felt as if my mind was scarred. Then something caught his attention, and he pulled the magazine away from me and started looking through it by himself. The images were a bright flame in the darkness, and he was a mindless moth. It only took a couple seconds before he was completely engrossed. "My, my, look at this!" He started describing what he was looking at. He was graphic and detailed. Hearing the things he was saying made me absolutely sick. I was so embarrassed, so shocked. I felt so slimy and scared. He became so absorbed in the pornography that I think he forgot that I was even there. When he got to the last page, he looked up with his greedy, evil eyes. Then he stood up and walked toward me. The pornography had lit a violent flame inside him, and so he raped me. And that was my first day in my new home.